Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. It's the day we talk about the management of chronic lymphocytic leukemia with Dr. Lindsay Roker from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City and Dr. Jeff Sharman from the U.S. Oncology Network and the Wilmot Valley Cancer Institute and Research Center in Eugene, Oregon. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Dr. Abramson on key presentations from recent conferences. So we're going to talk about here to talk about chronic lymphocytic leukemia, particularly, of course, what happened at the ASH meeting. And as we do in all these year in review programs, I met with both of the faculty separately to record in-depth presentations going through a whole bunch of papers. So we really envision this as a three-part experience. Hopefully, you'll be able to watch both of their presentations. Here are the papers that they cover. If you could check these presentations out, you'll get a lot more out of what we're about to talk about right now, which is really some of the key themes that came out in these papers and some of the questions that we're hearing from oncologists about CLL and how these data sets contribute to the understanding of these issues. So here's what we've got cooked up for today. I dreamed up this thing last night, and our faculty is good enough to go along with it. We're going to start out talking about the biology of the resistance in CLL, but we're not using any slides because that's the way it is when you're listening or making rounds, although we got a bunch of slides that you might want to check out later and papers. Then we're going to get into the papers that Jeff covered. Then we'll talk about some questions that come up. Then the papers that Lindsay got into in terms of future directions. But as we were chatting about, as we get ready in the last half an hour, you know, one of the things I personally find is a lot of difficulty trying to understand all these graphics about mechanism of action and resistance that we see in every kind of cancer, particularly CLL, where particularly the resistance story. So I just put in the introduction, a bunch of papers I really recommend for you to check out if you want to understand more about how these really fascinating therapies work. We're just going to do a little bit of a tasting menu here and just let the faculty chat for a few minutes. So, Lindsay, just imagine, you know, you're walking down the hall. You don't have any slides with you. You've got a bunch of fellows. And they go, well, how does the BCL2 as venetoclax work? And what do we know about resistance of venetoclax? So without slides, can you kind of talk about how you would explain to your fellows the way these agents work and why they stop work and what we know about that?
Absolutely. So I think of BCL2 as basically being the stop mechanism that prevents our cells from exploding. And then when you inhibit that, you explode the cell. So this is all mitochondrial based, and think of it as a protein that goes in, and it when that protein goes in and disrupts the mitochondria, the cell gets a signal to pop open and die. The BCL2 protein is actually inhibiting that thing from popping into the mitochondria, that protein. So by putting venetoclax in, you're blocking the blocker, basically, and that leads to cell death. So when I'm talking to patients about this, I describe that, you know, BCL2 inhibitors go in and they allow the cell to undergo the process that would happen if it were told to die. And that allows for basically apoptosis. The resistance story with venetoclax is a little bit tricky because there are BCL2 mutations mm-hmm. that can develop, but we're still learning more about how that really works because not all patients who become resistant to venetoclax have a BCL2 mutation. So we know that there are some BCL2 mutations that come up, but it's not for every patient.
So I want to also get into, of course, BTK, where it seems a lot more relevant, particularly for people in practice. But, you know, Jeff, when we were talking about this before we got started, you made a really interesting comment that CLL really is leading the way in oncology and understanding drug resistance. Can you kind of elaborate on that a little? Because, again, particularly with liquid biopsies, now we're seeing this in solid tumors.
Yeah, I think CLL can really serve as a model and template for how we understand a lot of cancers. And part of that's because it's so readily available to us. You know, just by drawing a phlebotomy, we can oftentimes ascertain what's going on. And one of the things we see during the longitudinal course of a patient treated with CLL are these ebbs and flows of various subclones. So in truth, when a patient comes in the door for the first time with CLL, they don't have one disease. They probably have a multitude of CLL subclones. And some of them may be small fractions, 1%, less than 1%, 2%, 3%, small amounts. So you might not notice them. But then under selective pressure, you get outgrowth of these resistant subpopulations. And a number of papers over the years have looked at this because, again, in CLL, you can do it so readily. And you can see how a dominant clone can disappear, a new clone can emerge, and then that second clone can be eliminated, and yet a third and fourth clone can evolve simultaneously. And for that one example, there might be two or three other ways it can happen. And where it becomes important and relevant now is particularly with the BTK resistance mutations. We first became aware of cysteine 481 serine as the sort of quintessential BTK resistance mutation. That was the binding site for ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, and zanubrutinib. But we now have additional molecules, pirtobrutinib. And so we're seeing different resistance mutations. And over time, we can see how these ebb and flow. And I think it's a model for what we see in other cancers, in lung cancer, EGFR mutations, and breast cancer, ESR1 mutations, and so forth, and how these things can evolve over time.
So there was a great presentation at ASH by Jennifer Brown from Dana-Farber looking at pirtobrutinib, but she had this graphic in there that I thought was really interesting and maybe to explore a little bit, kind of taking what you just said to the next level. But before we get into that, I want to just go back to you, Lindsay, in terms of Jeff was talking about some of the resistance mutations that are picked up with people on BTK inhibitors. Has this gotten to a point now where, at least with investigators, it actually affects your clinical decision-making? Are you looking at this?
So I'm checking for it. And when people have kind of that canonical BTK cis481S mutation that suggests resistance to a BTK inhibitor, a covalent BTK inhibitor specifically, I know that that's really a patient who has resistance through that mechanism. And that's when pirtobrutinib has activity. We know that pirtobrutinib works just as well for people with that cis481S mutation as for those who don't have it. So, you know, if a patient is progressing on a covalent BTK inhibitor, switching to another covalent BTK inhibitor isn't going to be an effective strategy, whether or not you find this mutation. But I think it does kind of, it's right now kind of a practice where I think we're learning what to do with it, with those data as they come back.
So quick follow-up from the chat room from Swati. Lindsay wants to know, like, which assay can they order this? Like, what do they do? Can you order it?
It's a great question. So I know that there are CLL resistance panels that you can order. Like NeoGenomics has one, for instance, where you can send it out and have that testing done.
So, Jeff, we could spend the whole hour just talking about this, and I wish we would because I really would love to know more about it. But I'll just take another shot at kind of getting a little bit into how pirtobrutinib works, because it's kind of maybe not what I was expecting exactly, but this graphic, you know, I think really helps explain it. You have there the cis481 that Lindsay was talking about, but can you talk about these gatekeeper kinase dead mutations, and then what happens when pirtobrutinib actually, that which is all of the there on the right, when pirtobrutinib binds?
So let me just start with like a first principle here, which is that BTK is central to B cell survival. And when you start inhibiting BTK, the cell and the cancer is going to try to find a way around that in inhibitor. And that's where these resistance mutations come in. And not all BTK inhibitors are function the same way. So although they all bind sort of in the same area on the molecule, they are held in place in different ways. So the first and second generation BTK inhibitors, ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, and zanubrutinib, they actually form a chemical bond that once it attaches to the BTK enzyme will never be broken. So that BTK enzyme is like taken offline. And as the cell, the reason you continue to take the drug is because the cell will resynthesize BTK. In contrast, pirtobrutinib does not bind like that. It actually just fits real snugly in the pocket. And so without requiring this permanent bond to form, what that means is that pirtobrutinib can work when the covalent inhibitors have stopped working. Now, the specifics of the mutations, the cysteine 41 serine was, like Lindsay mentioned, the canonical, it was the first we identified. And that actually is the binding site for ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, and zanubrutinib. Now, these other mutations may actually be what confer resistance to pirtobrutinib. So your listeners have undoubtedly thought about gatekeeper mutations in CML, right? And so people switch to ponatinib or asciminib in that situation. And in the same way, a gatekeeper mutation can block pirtobrutinib from accessing the BTK binding pocket. And then kinase dead mutations are, as Lindsay points out, stuff we're really just learning about, which is that BTK has functions not only in just, you know, adding phosphate groups to other enzymes, but it has like the scaffolding role. And simply even having BTK present, even if the kinase doesn't work, affords some survival function to the CLL cell. And this is where yet new drugs may be coming in, what we call BTK degraders, that can actually cause the cell to not only stop, turn off the enzyme, but get rid of the enzyme altogether. So that's where this storyline's going.
So, and Lindsay, you know, we're hearing about degraders like estrogen receptor degraders in breast cancer, androgen receptor degraders. Like, how do these degraders for BTK work? Get rid of the BTK?
Yeah, so they basically go in and they tag the protein with signals so that the cell actually gets rid of that BTK protein.
So again, I recommend you check out some of the papers we put in the introduction here. Just wanted to kind of talk a little bit about this. We could talk a lot more about it, but let's start getting into some specific papers that were covered by the two of you. Of course, Jeff covered the paper we were just talking about with Jennifer Brown, but let's go through some of these other ones. Several of these papers, Jeff, that you covered had to do with a follow-up from the first-line ibrutinib studies. And one that you talked about that I've been thinking about ever since you talked to me, I want to see what Lindsay thinks about, is this CLL12 study in high-risk people. You know, the issue of, you know, should you treat somebody who traditionally wouldn't fit the criteria for treatment, but they've got del17p, you know, the high risk, unmutated, etc. And Jeff, maybe you can talk about this study where they saw a tremendous progression-free survival advantage, as you might guess, but no survival advantage. Jeff, what were your thoughts about this? You know, one thing I was struck by was how they were able to identify asymptomatic people who had progression so quickly.
Yeah, I think that's maybe the strength of this paper to some degree is that their model so accurately predicts who's going to experience progression. And a lot of these are features that we use routinely already, IGHV mutation status, del17P, but there are other ones, thymidine kinase and so forth, which are less commonly used. And, you know, go back in time, the 1990s, when the only drugs we had were, you know, in the pre-fludarabine era, all we had was chlorambucil. The big study then was chlorambucil versus watch and wait in asymptomatic patients. And not surprisingly, you could get a response, but you didn't improve survival. This is really asking about early ibrutinib versus ibrutinib when indicated. So can we find a group where the risk is high enough that they're going to need therapy soon? And if we start therapy sooner, does it matter? Ibrutinib is not the drug to do this, I think, is the long story short. You only are going to start therapy earlier if you're actually changing really important outcomes like overall survival. And in this study, yes, you could delay progression, but you would expect that of ibrutinib. But if you then just used ibrutinib at the time they progressed, their survival ended up the same. I think one of the things that was most interesting in this study was it was a placebo-controlled study. And I think we oftentimes sort of criticize ibrutinib for its side effects and so forth, but the side effects of placebo in CLL are actually relatively significant, and that's on your screen right now, and you see serious adverse events that are actually higher in the placebo than in ibrutinib. And I think that just goes to highlight that these patients are sick and they're going to have symptoms, and whether or not you can attribute things to their drug or not is maybe the main take home from this study. We have not changed when we start therapy based on this study.
So yeah, Lindsay, I was telling Jeff, there was a big study in small cell of the lung where they had control for an IO immunotherapy, and the placebo group had 25% autoimmune toxicities, highlighting Jeff's point about how it's so hard, particularly in a long evolving situation like CLL, to figure out what you're actually dealing with. There was one thing that was kind of interesting, though, is there were less second, am I right, Jeff? Less second yep. cancers in the ibrutinib group. And also, I was thinking, Lindsay, you know, it's one thing, you know, the traditional concept of, you know, watch and wait, yeah, sure, for the average patient. But these people look like they're going to progress and get symptomatic like within a year. You know, I could see that a patient, an informed patient, may, knowing that, might want to be treated. I don't know. Any thoughts?
I think that it's a common question we get in clinic is like, if we know that treatment's coming, can I just start now? And would that be better? I think these data suggest that, you know, probably that there's not a survival benefit. I think the long-term follow-up of this is going to be interesting. If you're a modifying, you know, clonal evolution earlier, does that confer a benefit? I don't think we would necessarily anticipate that we would have that answer within, you know, the time frame that we've seen here, even though there is quite long follow-up. The pieces that for these asymptomatic patients are really problematic, right, are second cancers and infection risk. And I think that here we see that there is probably some benefit from the malignancy risk. And I think that that is compelling. And then I think the infectious risk is the second piece that, you know, we don't think that necessarily treating is helping that part. But I, like Jeff said, I think that there are other drugs that we use more. The problem with all of these studies is that they're designed in an era where the drug is what you use, and then the field shifts. And, you know, by the time you have the readout that much longer, the standard of care has changed. So, you know, there are ongoing studies looking at early intervention with venetoclax and obinutuzumab, which I think will also be informative. But for right now, I think the data-driven choice is waiting until patients require therapy per the criteria, per the IWCLL criteria.
So another thing I thought was interesting, Jeff, in these data that we were talking about was this thing here, the fact that CTC grade 5, which they don't exactly say exactly what it was, these four patients, it was 4 in ibrutinib, 1 in placebo. I wonder, any thoughts about to what extent we're able to capture, understand sudden death? Like if you have a patient who, you know, the police call, you hear about cases like this all the time, you know, the patient died of natural causes, and you look back, they were on, you know, BTK inhibitor. Any thoughts about perhaps whether ventricular arrhythmias might be more important than we think? And what do we know? I know you had a review looking, I think it was in looking at acalabrutinib, trying to understand whether the other agents, acalabrutinib and Zanu, are associated with this ventricular arrhythmia. Any thoughts?
The big question in the field right now is this a feature that's unique to ibrutinib, or is this a drug class effect? And it's hard to be definitive when something is rare and infrequent. The FDA label for ibrutinib, and really what we see in virtually all the studies, is that there is a rate of sudden death amongst patients treated with ibrutinib that comes out around like 1 to 1.5% in these studies. We're not seeing that in the other studies, but when you're talking about such an infrequent complication, it's hard to be definitive. We published a paper where we looked at, you know, 5 studies with acalabrutinib and tried to see, you know, in the combined, you know, aggregate study, and then look at the control arms and so forth. And I would say that we didn't perceive that there is a risk of sudden cardiac death with acalabrutinib, but I have to say that the limitations of the methodology prevent us from being as definitive as we would like to be.
So I'm going to jump into another issue that Jeff got into. We read a whole bunch of papers. I really recommend you sit down and go through all this, but really getting to the issue of acalabrutinib and zanabrutinib. I want to get your take on this, Lindsay. First, any situations right now outside of clinical trial setting where you're starting somebody on ibrutinib? And then how do you sort through the choice between zanabrutinib and acalabrutinib? You know, are there patients that you prefer one versus the other? Any thoughts about the advantage that was seen with zanabrutinib over ibrutinib? What about factoring CD20? Let's just talk a little bit rather than talk about the papers. Let's talk about what your impression is of the data.
Yeah. So in terms of the use of ibrutinib, very, very rarely starting patients on ibrutinib as a new drug. The only thing that we really know differentiates ibrutinib is, or one of the few things, is the CNS penetration. So if you have somebody who you know they have CNS disease and you need to get drug in, that is one consideration. In terms of the second generation drugs, both work great. The studies in the relapse refractory setting are different. They're different patient populations. They were performed at different times. So I don't think we can use the transitive property to say in the relapse setting, zanabrutinib has a PFS benefit over ibrutinib, acalabrutinib doesn't. So therefore, zanabrutinib is better than acalabrutinib. The studies are too different to really say that that's the case. In terms of how I choose between them, I really use often what patients describe as symptoms that are bothersome to them. So there are people who are headache people. Headache people tend to get more headaches with acalabrutinib. If I have a patient who has a history of GI side effects, zanabrutinib does tend to cause a bit more GI toxicity with diarrhea or abdominal pain. So for those patients, I do tend to favor acalabrutinib. Both are, I think, very appropriate strategies. For acalabrutinib, we are seeing that there is a progression-free survival benefit of adding obinutuzumab for patients in the frontline setting, except for those patients who have TP53 aberrations. So I'm talking to patients about it. It's a little bit tricky in that often when people are trying to, when you're sorting out all of these options in clinic and you say, okay, we can do fixed duration venetoclax obinutuzumab, we can do continuous acalabrutinib or zanabrutinib. Often the reason that people are selecting one versus the other, if there's not a compelling comorbidity to drive you one direction or the other, is the ease of use of a BTK inhibitor, right? I don't have to come in for infusions. I don't have to do these things. So I talk to my patients about it, but generally I find that people do like the simplicity of a BTK inhibitor as a monotherapy, but I would be really interested in how Jeff approaches that discussion as the man who brought us the data.
So we were talking about these new data, I guess, that Jeff just presented at ASH from the ELEVATE study, and this is where we started to see this increasing benefit with obinutuzumab.
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot to this data, and I completely understand Lindsay's sentiments about how patients sort of sort themselves out. Obinutuzumab is a funny drug. It's clearly superior to rituximab now in several randomized studies in CLL, and yet rituximab was always such an enormous franchise, and docs were so familiar with it. And when the infusion toxicity was first noted with obinutuzumab, I think docs were hesitant to use it. And so it never quite gathered the traction that rituximab always had. And in this particular study, we did the whole study pre-COVID. And of course, the results started trickling out in the middle of COVID when people were understandably apprehensive of using obinutuzumab for fear of diminishing vaccine response and so forth. Personally, I find the data significant enough to inform my practice, and I think a lot of it depends, even as much as like the geography in which you practice. You know, I'm in a community practice
Patients never have to drive more than like 10 minutes to my clinic. They park in our front parking lot, walk into the clinic and get their labs drawn. And 10 minutes later, I'm seeing them. And 10 minutes after that, they're in the infusion room. I could imagine if you're in New York City and you're coming in from Mid Island and you got to navigate the tunnels and find parking and so forth, it could be very different. But to me, the significant improvement in PFS, 16% absolute. And in fact, there's what appears to be maybe even an emerging survival benefit. To me, I feel like it's my obligation to figure out who shouldn't get it rather than who should. And I acknowledge that the field hasn't necessarily adopted that approach as much as I have, but I've obviously been pretty close to this data for a while.
We've got some cool stuff in the chat room, Lindsay. You want to hear it?
Yep.
Okay. So Susanna says, I had a patient with severe arthralgias when zanubrutinib did not occur after holding and then dose reduction.
Yeah.
Have you seen this?
Absolutely. And I think, one advantage with zanubrutinib is it does offer a lot of flexibility from a dose reduction perspective. So that's a nice feature as well.
Another one, I told you we have some great people here in the chat room. This is really interesting from Rajiv, who has a 71-year-old man who's been on acalabrutinib with good control for a year, developed severe oral and penile sores that appear to be herpetic-like, mm-hmm. was seen by infectious disease, who said it was rare to get both oral and genital herpes simultaneously and thought it might be mucositis from acalabrutinib. Ever heard of that or seen it, Lindsay?
I've seen a couple of cases of mucositis. I've seen it improve with drug holds. That's a person who I would probably put on antiviral prophylaxis, even if they're saying that it's not. I've also seen simultaneous outbreaks of HSV. So I would probably put that person on acyclovir, maybe drug hold until they clear out the sores, and then restart and see if it recurs, and then keep them on prophylaxis.
That's great input. One more from the chat room. Mian asks, Lindsay, can zanubrutinib cause neuropathy?
I've also seen a couple of cases of people with pre-existing neuropathy that seems to worsen on therapy. And you always question whether that's actually drug or not. Going back to the discussion about placebo and the side effects from placebo, we know that people who have underlying neuropathy, that is in many cases going to progress. I've also seen it with ibrutinib. I've also seen it with acalabrutinib. So to what extent there is underlying neuropathy that is just going to progress anyway versus drug effect, I think we don't really know. But that's one that's a little bit trickier because drug hold doesn't necessarily seem to reverse it. So that one's a little bit harder. Which whenever that's the case, it always makes me question whether it's actually just an underlying process too.
So I want to kind of pick up the pace here a little bit and kind of pick out some of these other papers that I think people would find interesting. Lindsay, here are some papers looking at venetoclax combinations that Jeff talked about in his review. One thing I want to ask you about is this idea of accelerating the venetoclax escalation, reducing the amount of time people have. And I think there have been various attempts at that. Is that a strategy you ever utilize? And any thoughts about that?
For my standard, we just need to start venetoclax for an indication, but not like this is an emergency. I tend to stick to the 5-week dose escalation. But obviously these emerging data suggest that there are ways we can do it in an alternate strategy and that's safe. For people where there are more pressing needs to get venetoclax on to a therapeutic level. So for instance, the people who are progressing on a BTK inhibitor and that's not they really have their disease taking off, or patients who are coming in with frontline therapy that really need a quick response. Those are the patients where I'm using more rapid dose escalations. And just because we don't have such solid, the data that were presented at ASH are obviously changing this a little bit, but I think that up to this point, we haven't had like great data to say, okay, go for it. So I usually do that in the inpatient setting to make sure that I'm not hurting anyone with that approach, but I certainly have done that.
So let's talk a little bit about pirtobrutinib. Of course, it just got approved in CLL and previously approved in mantle cell. I was surprised it wasn't approved in CLL a year ago. I know everybody was like chomping at the bit. I'm not sure why it took so long, but anyhow, it finally got done. Jeff, can you talk, maybe kind of bring us up to date on what we have learned and are learning about this agent? And in particular, how are you right now integrating it into your practice?
The number of patients who have experienced treatment progression following a prior covalent BTK inhibitor and BCL2 inhibitor has been a relatively small group for community practice doctors. There's just not a whole lot of patients who've experienced progression following both those. But I would argue that it's a increasing group and somewhat rapidly increasing group as these other agents have been out there longer. Sloan Kettering was the hotbed for this study. So Lindsay, I'm sure, would have lots of good comments on it. But in effect, you can salvage a patient who has had these two prior agents. Very good response rates. I think that as the data has matured, we've been a little bit disappointed with the progression-free survival that has been seen. And if somebody's had a prior BCL2 inhibitor, it appears to be less than patients who haven't been treated with prior BCL2 inhibitor, with the difference being 16 months versus 23 months median PFS. I think that this can serve as a useful bridge to something else. Where am I using it? I have a couple patients on it right now where I'm kind of counting on CAR-T being approved in the next handful of months, and or bridge to allo transplant for some patients, which isn't a super common issue in CLL, but it does come up.
So Lindsay, as Jeff was saying, you all there at Memorial probably use it more than anybody in the world. I'm curious what your experience is, also particularly with tolerability. I think you probably, in terms of quality of life, I don't know if you can even compare it to the covalent. Also, your thoughts about where things are heading. We talked about this trial, the Bruin CLL 322, a phase 3 study, kind of like Murano plus or minus pirtobrutinib, but sounds super cool to me. Any thoughts, Lindsay?
I think pirto is an incredible drug in that it is very well tolerated. People do incredibly well on pirto, and phase one, two data always look a little bit different than they do once we get phase three data. So it'll be interesting to see what this, with the upcoming phase three studies, what the toxicity profile looks like. But from the patients I have treated, people do very, very well with minimal side effects. I think the Pirto-Ven-R versus the Ven-R study is going to be incredibly informative, because if we know that there is, a time-limited second-line option and we're able to achieve deeper responses so that people have longer treatment-free observation windows afterward, especially with some of the data that we saw at ASH about emergence of resistance with time-limited therapy. And I think reassuringly, we found out that when people are getting combinations of BTK inhibitors and BCL2 inhibitors for time-limited therapy, there doesn't seem to be a ton of resistance developing in that short duration. I think if we're seeing the same thing in second line, where deepening responses allows for a better treatment-free observation window plus a longer treatment-free observation window plus the ability to retreat because we haven't developed resistance, I think that's going to be a great advance for patients with CLL.
Let's get back to the data and what it means. So, of course, if you had to pick a question I'd really like an answer to, it's this one. Where does BTK plus venetoclax fit in, or where's it going to fit in? Jeff, to me, the thing I like about it is kind of the convenience, or at least theoretically. I don't know if it's better, than obinutuzumab and venetoclax, but I wonder if the patient's quality of life might be better. You tell me. What are your thoughts about where this is heading, Jeff?
Boy, I think the FDA kind of got themselves painted into a corner on this one. Ibrutinib with venetoclax is approved throughout the world in many jurisdictions, but not in the U.S. And that was based upon the results of what was known as the GLOW study. And the reason it didn't get approved in the U.S. was that the early data showed that the toxicity profile of the combination in older patients was actually worse than obinutuzumab chlorambucil for a period of time. But as that data has matured, that early toxicity signal has been reversed, or what's the right way to say it, overcome by the magnitude of benefit. The PFS for this is really good. Now, ibrutinib has always been a difficult medication in older patients. And when we look at the CAPTIVATE study, which is a younger population of patients, you just don't see the same toxicity profile. I actually still feel very comfortable using ibrutinib in combination with venetoclax in a younger population. I don't feel comfortable using it in an older population. Where's this going? I don't necessarily see the combination of ibrutinib venetoclax being approved in the U.S., or at least I don't see traction in that direction. However, we will have data of acalabrutinib in combination with venetoclax that should be reading out before too terribly long. And then Beijing is doing a study with zanabrutinib and sonrotoclax. So I think that BTK-BCL2 will be an option, just maybe not with ibrutinib with venetoclax.
Lindsay, I'm curious about your thoughts on this. You heard that we're doing this program of physicians with breast cancer. Be interesting, physicians with CLL who understand all these data, how they what they might want to do. Any thoughts about where the strategy is heading, and also whether, again, you have the anti-CD20, whether that's going to be along for the ride?
Yeah, so the CD20 question, I think, is the one that we have probably the best data for now. So Jennifer Wyack's presentation of the IVO versus IO data basically looked at whether it's better to receive the triplet versus ibrutinib and obinutuzumab, and it turns out it's not better to get the triplet. So I think that's informative. And again, I don't know that we can extrapolate this to the second generation drugs because toxicity profiles are different. But I think that probably we're going to find that we don't need that third drug, would be my guess. In terms of, you know, do we use these drugs? I think these drugs together, I mean, I think the FLAIR study looked outstanding, right? Like the progression-free survival looks great. The overall survival looks great. It's obviously a little bit of a different strategy where you're MRD adapted, but on drug for longer. And reassuringly, patients are not developing these resistance mutations that are leading to, you know, inability to retreat down the road. So I do think that there's going to be a future for BTK-BCL2 inhibitors, but I agree with Jeff. I don't think it's with ibrutinib and venetoclax.
Yeah, Jeff, the idea of bringing MRD into CLL in general, but also into these combinations, of course, is a big issue out there. I'm curious, maybe you can talk a little bit about what they do in the FLAIR study, you know, how they like take the amount of time it takes to get MRD and then they double it and all this. Is that what we're going to be doing in practice?
I don't think we're going to be doing anything as complex as what FLAIR did. We might do something more simple than that. Now, specifically what they did was they treated patients for 12 months, and then they did an assessment of their MRD. And if they were MRD negative, they treated them for a total of 24 months. If they're MRD positive, they rechecked 6 months later at a year and a half. And if they're MRD negative, then they treated for a total of 3 years. And if it was 2 years, then they treated for 4 years. You know, there's like this doubling. You double the length of time it took to get you to MRD negative. Now, a couple issues. That was done by flow cytometry, whereas I think most studies in the U.S. that are looking at MRD as any sort of regulatory endpoint will be doing so at the molecular level with PCR. And, you know, I think it's possible we could see something evolve where, hey, we check you in a year, and if you're positive, we treat you to 2 years, and if you're negative, you stop. But even that is not data-driven yet. So I don't think that's ready for prime time. MRD has always struggled to figure out where it fits in CLL because it hasn't ever been standardized in a way that the regulatory agencies could make actionable. So for now, MRD is still descriptive rather than telling you how to treat somebody.
So Lindsay, Joseph in the chat room wants to know your approach to patients who are anticoagulated, and you would like to give them a BTK inhibitor.
Yeah. If they're on a direct oral anticoagulant, totally okay to use them together. Just be mindful of bleeding. Warfarin's a no-go, so they can't be on warfarin plus BTK inhibitor.
So let's talk a little bit about new agents and strategies that are being looked at. And again, let's just sort of chat about it. You can check out the presentation that Lindsay did that goes through all this. Nemtabrutinib, Lindsay, what is that and why is it different, or is it any different than what we already have with pirtobrutinib?
It's a non-covalent BTK inhibitor, so mechanism's very similar to pirtobrutinib. It's, you know, being developed in CLL. It does seem to have activity in both CIS481S mutated as well as the non-mutated patients. Also has some activity in other NHLs. From a development perspective, somewhat behind pirtobrutinib, but I think also being explored.
Jeff, you were very involved in the development of ibrutinib. Can you talk a little bit about how that evolved and what you think about some of these new BTK inhibitors coming along? I guess there was also, a SYK inhibitor before that was being looked at, but maybe you can just sort of tell us a little bit about how that evolved and when did that occur?
So I first thought that inhibiting B-cell receptor signaling would be a good idea in 2004, and then I started working on a SYK inhibitor at that time. And if you look at these signaling cascades, kind of the first enzyme in the triangle or the top of the pyramid is SYK, and we were just going to work our way down the pyramid to figure out which one to inhibit. SYK served as a proof of concept. The molecule we used at the time was called fostamatinib, and fostamatinib is now actually approved by the FDA for the treatment of ITP. We then moved on to what was then PCI-32765, which became ibrutinib. And, you know, how did it evolve? You know, we had this, there's a great history of going from chlorambucil to fludarabine cyclophosphamide to FCR. And then all of a sudden we get something totally out of left field that ends up being superior to it. And we've now seen in several studies that BTK is superior to even our most intensive frontline chemotherapy regimens. So it's really upended, you know, where it's relevant to, you know, your listeners is when patients come in and they see me, I say, look, you know, this field changed in 2014. That's a very specific time. Like anything pre-2014 was chemoimmunotherapy and post-2014 was CLL. And then of course, venetoclax and obinutuzumab after that. So I think, what's fun about knowing that is when a patient's coming in, you can just tell them how recently these developments are and any preconceptions they oftentimes have of cancer and chemotherapy and so forth is probably outdated if it's more than a couple years old.
Really amazing to watch this transpire. Let's talk about some of the other things maybe that'll be in the future of CL or even the present. And one, of course, is CAR-T. You reviewed a paper from Ash looking at lisocaptagene. Where are we today in general with CAR-T and CLL, Lindsay?
So I think the take-home message from this was that if you respond, that's awesome and you have a durable response, but the response rates are relatively low. So I think we're still figuring out how, who is responding well to the CAR-T we have now, and then for the people who are not responding so great, how can we make CAR-T better? And I think a lot of this has to do with, we know that T cell function in patients with CLL is somewhat inhibited. There's a repertoire of T cells that tend to be more regulatory, less cytotoxic. There's the CLL cells themselves have sort of an inhibitory type B cell type of characteristic. So I think that we're going to have to figure out how we get T cells to really work against CLL well, and I think that's an ongoing project.
So let's talk a little bit about Richter's transformation. And before we do, you know, one of the things that I was interested in, we were talking about the infectious risk with CLL, And you, now you, you're actually starting to see some survival benefit in some of your trials out there. And I think it maybe, and I don't know how much of that had to do with COVID, but it just kind of brought up the whole idea of, Jeff, of how to look at CLL. You know, I've always had this idea that you can't, you know, you're not going to affect the survival, you know, you're going to affect a people's quality of life. But then when you start thinking about infection and how that might affect it, I wonder if, you know, maybe it has more of an effect on survival than we think it does. Any thoughts about how, you know, I think we were looking at some data earlier with, I think it was pirtobrutinib, where you see it looks like less infection as the disease gets better controlled. I think you saw that. Any thoughts about, you know, sort of whether what we're actually doing with these therapies in the long run, Jeff? Are we functionally curing anybody?
You know, I think some of the most fascinating data on this has come out of the study of monoclonal B-cell lymphocytosis. So, of course, this is like CLL light. You know, these are just laboratory abnormalities. And one of the observations that even the presence of monoclonal B-cell lymphocytosis and the absence of any therapy or any sort of CLL treatment, that these patients have higher rates of pneumonias, higher rates of urinary tract infections, cutaneous infections. And as Lindsay comments, CLL itself has kind of an immunosuppressive effect. And I think it stands to reason that less CLL means less immunosuppression, but at what cost? You know, back when we used fludarabine was exquisitely toxic to T cells and rendered them less functional for the remainder of somebody's lifetime. Fludarabine could be terribly render patients with durable cytopenias and so forth. So, you know, with novel agents, there was an interesting study looking at vaccine responses to the different classes of agents. And, you know, patients who'd been treated with venetoclax monotherapy actually responded quite well to vaccines. So, you know, to me, that means a deep, well-responding CLL patient can actually have pretty good immune function. CD20 antibodies are obviously immunosuppressive to some degree, and I think BTK is probably somewhere between those two. I don't know exactly how much.
Lindsay, I'm curious, you know, certainly you were right in the middle of the COVID pandemic when it began, and devastating things going on there in New York City at that time. How do you think that affected the survival of your patients? Did you see a material difference during that time? And any thoughts about how infection contributes to mortality in these patients? The reason I bring it up, we're about to talk about Richter's transformation, but I think actually, even though it's very common, it's more common to die without Richter's transformation. I don't know, these people die of infections. Any thoughts, Lindsay?
Yeah, I mean, we had a really hard, really bad time with COVID. Our patients had really bad outcomes in a lot of cases. And I think for me, there were several lessons learned. The first was be mindful of getting people vaccinated well. And I knew that before, but I think now it's even become more of a theme is make sure that anything you can do to protect yourself from infections, you're doing. So staying up to date on those vaccines, I think, is important. The other thing is paying attention to hypogammaglobulinemia. Mm-hmm. We saw early on that IVIG in the setting of COVID actually was one of the few things that really did help patients with CLL from a survival perspective. And that was all based on, you know, single center data when we were like in the midst of it and like, what do we do? But IVIG did seem to help. More long lasting, I pay a lot of attention to hypogammaglobulinemia. Yeah. And if I have a patient who is hypogamma and, you know, the first couple colds, I get them on IVIG, whereas before maybe that wasn't so much of a focus.
Yeah. Neil, can I piggyback on that? Because I think it's a point that can't be overemphasized. Hypogammaglobulinemia is a major problem for our patients with CLL, and I think most docs aren't checking for it. The typical story is the patient who gets the upper respiratory infection that lingers for a month and they can't shake it. And they go through four courses of antibiotics and they feel miserable. And, you know, maybe they get admitted with a pneumonia or so forth. But IVIG can really be life altering for these patients. And if you're not looking, you're not thinking about it. And so it's so easy to just send an IgG level. And I think it's a very important point that Lindsay makes.
These are really great points. Let's talk a little bit about Richter's. And before we get into these papers, Lindsay, anything you want to say about making the diagnosis of Richter's? You know, I think people are pretty sensitized to it. But also, when you look at a patient, how you kind of evaluate them in terms of prognosis. Of course, it is not a good situation in general, but there are people who do better than others. How do you sort of initially pick this up and sort of evaluate what's going on?
Yeah, so the clinical features that I look for are a node that's growing out of proportion to the rest, really rapid progression. Those are the patients where I tend to look for PET, do a PET scan to make sure that I'm not missing something. And then really profound cytopenias can be another tip-off. So those are other pieces. Along with checking immunoglobulin levels, I also trend LDH because I want to make sure, first of all, that they're not hemolyzing, but also that I catch it if their LDH is really rising, which can be a suggestion that there's a Richter's transformation happening. In terms of the second question about how they do, one of the most important pieces is whether it's clonally related to their CLL or not. And in many cases, this is really hard to suss out. Here we do IGHV sequencing on a CLL clone and then look at the large cell clone and see if they match. Now, of course, that requires that you have the DNA in order to do that from the original sample. And in some cases, it's not possible, but it does seem like clonal relatedness really does matter. The people who are clonally unrelated are probably more like de novo DLBCL, whereas the people who are clonally related are going to have likely less good outcomes. And I think one of the major points of Richter's transformation is that these people don't do well with R-CHOP or with standard kind of chemoimmunotherapy approaches, which is why this list is filled with drugs that you wouldn't expect to be using for, large cell lymphoma. And we're really looking for novel approaches and ways to treat these patients better.
So, of course, checkpoint inhibitors is raised here in a couple of papers. The first one with venetoclax and atezo and abino. The second one, tislelizumab, was zanubrutinib. Jeff, how do the checkpoint inhibitors in general look in Richter's?
There is some surprising activity of the checkpoint inhibitors. And one of the challenges in Richter's is that it's such an infrequent population that doing rigorous studies in this population is a challenge. You know, you get these case series of 18 to 20 patients, and even that's a big series. And oftentimes things look good in single institution experiences and so forth. But keep in mind, if you borrow from the solid tumor literature, where patients with high tumor burden high mutation burden are more likely to respond to checkpoint inhibitors. I like to think of Richter's in the same way. These patients almost universally have TP53 mutations, and they're maybe a little bit more immunogenic. And you do see responses with the checkpoint inhibitors, maybe 30 to 40%. How durable they are kind of depends upon the presentation. The Molto study that you have referenced was sort of an outlier to the high side. But I think Lindsay's point that R-CHOP is particularly ineffective in a clonally related population holds true.
So how about pirtobrutinib? I think there was some data at ASH 2022 from the Bruin, from your place, I think. I was all excited about it. And then we saw some more data. Where is pirtobrutinib heading in terms of Richter's, Lindsay?
Pirtobrutinib has single agent activity for Richter's. It's not for everybody, but of the responders, it does seem to be a reasonable bridge. So I think of this as a strategy that might get somebody to CAR T, get somebody to allo. I'm you're always biased by the patients you see. Some of those deepest responses and longest durations of response have been my patients. So I have had people where this has really changed their life. They went from, thinking they're, failing chemoimmunotherapy to having a pill that they're taking and their drug is well controlled or their disease is well controlled. So, for a subset of patients, I think it is really an incredible advance.
So I told you we had a great chat room because we have another case I want to throw by you. And this is actually relevant to what we were chatting about before. I was saying, do you think there's anybody out there still getting chemoimmunotherapy first line? I hear these real world studies saying it happens. It's hard to believe, but maybe bringing up the issue, maybe they have difficulty accessing it. And then you said, well, maybe there are people actually where you might want to do that. I think, Lindsay, you said you actually had seen somebody recently, but tell me what you think about this case from Hassan. 55-year-old man presents with a white count of 700,000, hemoglobin of 6, platelet 15,000, bone marrow full CLL-like cells, flow atypical CLL 10%, 11-14 translocation. Lindsay, any thoughts?
700,000 is a really high number. I have done, in these settings where people have really, really high counts, I've done obinutuzumab lead-ins with the idea that I add in acalabrutinib and have had success with that. There's no reason to think you couldn't then add in venetoclax down the road. But with the obinutuzumab, the standard split of 100-900, for reasons that just feel good but are not data-driven, I've actually split it further. So I've done like 50-50 and then waited a bit before I give them a real dose to try to get some of the lysis out of the way without a huge dose of obinutuzumab to try to make sure that their kidneys are okay. Have G6PD status understood so that you can give them respiracase when their uric acid flies up too.
You know, there was one thing at the very end of that case, though. You said an 11-14 translocation, and I just want to make sure this isn't a blastic mantle cell. Check a TP53, maybe a second path consult, because oftentimes the distinction between mantle cell and CLL can be very subtle, particularly as CD23 can be dim at times, and that's sometimes the only flow cytometric difference between the two. So might really want to press the pathologist as to whether or not this could be a mantle cell.
Well, I guess I should say, what would you do if it was mantle cell?
That's an ugly mantle cell. I would typically suspect that patient has a TP53 mutation. You said it's young. I'm probably going to just try to get some cytotoxic in there a little bit in mantle cell, cytotoxic, to just get the counts under control. And then I would probably do either a triangle regimen or the high dose cytarabine intermittent with CHOP to auto transplant with rituximab maintenance. So in a young patient, I would be very aggressive.
Well, thank you so much. That was very interesting. Thanks for that great case. And thank you, Lindsay and Jeff, for sharing your experience and knowledge with us today. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Lindsay. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thank you.